Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
You're listening to Fields, the podcast. I'm Wyeth Marshall.
And I'm Melissa Metrick.
On Fields, we're bringing you the stories of people who are working in the world of urban agriculture. For money, for fun, for art, for justice, to feed the hungry, to green the city, or to uncover its history.
In each episode of Fields, we'll delve into one kind of food that's grown in cities, one technology used to grow, or one project that teaches us something about our relationship to farming in urban environments.
Moreover, we'll investigate all the whys behind getting up in the morning and working as a farmer in the city today.
You don't need to be a farmer to enjoy this podcast, or even a foodie.
We're going to tell fascinating stories and break down the realities and possible futures of urban farming to their elements. Hey, welcome to Fields, the unfinished story of urban agriculture. I'm Wyeth Marshall, and as always, we have...
Hi, I'm Melissa Metrick.
And our guest today is the amazing...
Jonas Günther.
From the company...
We are the New Farmers.
Ah, great. You have farmers in the title. It's very clear why you're here. It'll become very clear to our listeners shortly. Thank you so much for making time. It's great to see you again. And it's been great over the past few years to see your company develop from like initial idea to, you know, a thing with products that are really, really great. So we're going to talk today about creating a company in urban agriculture in New York City. And various other themes, but, you know, I'm really just excited more than that to just hear and talk as always about, today's crop, which is algae. A little spoiler for the rest of the conversation. Jonas, do you want to introduce yourself? Just tell us a little about your background and maybe just what is We Are the New Farmers. And before we sort of ask more questions.
Yeah, sure thing. It's always great to come back to you guys and talk to you. It's like, cause I literally know you from the beginning of my journey, and it's like, such a long process from the very first days to where we are today. And today we are an indoor farming company located in Brooklyn, in Sunset Park to be precise, and we're dedicated to the cultivation of microalgae.
Microalgae are tiny single-celled plants. Technically, they're phytoplankton, which just means tiny things that make their own energy. Each microalga is invisible to the naked eye, but seen together, they can look like beautiful blue-green foams or bright green or red or orange slimes. In fact, they can be all kinds of colors. Not all microalgae are edible, but some of them, like spirulina, are superfoods. Others provide natural sources of dyes and other useful materials.
The thing that makes them super interesting for us as humans is that they are insanely nutritious. They are very packed with vitamins and nutrients, but with protein dependent on the species, they can be very rich in fatty acids. They're insanely, it can turn carbon into the building blocks of life, whether that is vitamins and minerals, fatty acids, and so on. And they're very efficient in that because many of those organisms are extremely old and don't need a lot of resources to do so. We've been operating for 4.5 years. We're dedicated to one specific type of microalgae today, which is called spirulina, which a lot of your listeners probably know from the supplement aisle at Whole Foods or maybe from Amazon. And it's a blue-green algae that is extremely rich in plant-based protein and offers a widespread from all kinds of minerals, vitamins, and is often considered an extremely nutrient-dense food, sometimes also called superfood. And what makes us unique and why we decided to cultivate this type of algae here in New York City is because typically, this type of algae is something that is only grown overseas. The majority, actually, of all microalgae cultivation is happening in Southeast Asia and China. Like, it's all imported to the United States. And because that is so far away, people tend to dehydrate it into a powder that can have a rather unpleasant flavor and is a little bitter and a little fishy, and people really don't enjoy it. But eat it anyway, it's because it's healthy, at least supposedly. We thought there needs to be a better way. So we rethought the entire process really from the ground up, redeveloped entire methods to cultivate this type of spirulina or this type of algae in an urban center, to offer it in a different shape or form, which is fresh and unprocessed, following the belief that I probably think lots of your listeners will believe in too, that fresh foods are inherently better than dehydrated powders and processed foods. That's what we do. That's kind of the quick intro to We Are the New Farmers.
Jonas, I have a quick question. So what did you really like spirulina beforehand? Like, were you like a spirulina addict where you're like, I need to grow this fresh? Or was it kind of more of like you saw that there was a need for spirulina, and especially fresh spirulina, since it isn't usually grown here? Or was it kind of both?
My journey actually started from a completely different angle. Like, before I came to New York, when I started this project, I wasn't even familiar with spirulina. I wasn't familiar with microalgae overall. I was interested in the question of how do we want to grow food in the future when we are desperately in need of ways of doing so with a lower carbon impact. Like, how do we bring down the carbon emissions in our food system? I looked into different ways of cultivation and indoor farming and vertical farming. And one of the things that stood out to me was that, like, a friend of mine was working in microalgae and was working in microalgae for biofuels, which you may be familiar with. Like, 10 years ago, there was a huge rush into that. He introduced me to microalgae for the first time, and I looked into it, and I immediately got super, super curious. I was like, what is this thing? It, like, turns carbon into protein. It needs no arable land. It needs almost no fresh water. It is extremely healthy, like, extremely, extremely healthy, like packs. And yet no one's eating it. Like, why is no one consuming this? That's when I learned about powdered spirulina and the reasons why we have powdered spirulina, and thought about a way of, like, we need to find a better way of bringing this to people. Like, sometimes we internally refer to the challenge as simplifying algae. Like, today it can be very complicated, can be very difficult to use for people and off-putting for people. So we are on a mission to serve this in a way that is a lot more appealing and that can actually fit much easier into everyone's lifestyle. So no, I'm not a health nut. No, like, I'm a bit of a health nut, but I was not consuming spirulina on a day-to-day basis before. But I got piqued by this idea of cultivating a food that can potentially be carbon neutral.
Well, that's a great segue actually into two questions that I really wanted to ask, because I know you have a lot to say on this. And one is very simple, which is that idea of making it more appealing. So you're taking a crop, you know, in ag terms, that many people aren't familiar with. They're not thinking about growing single-celled plants. But in terms of cuisine, they're also probably not thinking about eating it. And as you said, maybe have encountered it, if they're real health nuts, as like a powder, a green fishy powder that you put it in stuff. But this is a different product. So maybe could you describe their product and how you cook with it? And then the second thing, there are two questions here, but I know you know some of the science now, a lot of the science now behind why it is good for you, how it is good for you, how it is better than the dried stuff. And it seems like there's a lot to say about the science in general, whether it's about climate or nutrition. So that's something maybe we can come back to, but I'm curious about how you've learned that, where it's going, what you'd still like to learn more about. But maybe to start, just to orient us, like, what does it look like? What does it taste like, smell like, all of that stuff? I feel like I kind of know, but I want to hear how you sort of pitch, you know, raw spirulina.
And eventually I would like to know how you grow it.
Yeah, I tend to forget that when you work with the product on a day-to-day basis, that it's not obvious at all how it looks like. So our product is fresh. And what it means is it comes as a paste, and it looks very similar to hummus in its consistency. It's kind of a mousse, if you will. The only difference to hummus is it's dark green. The algae that we cultivate is a blue-green algae. So imagine like literally a fur green color. It's like very, really dark green, very mesmerizing, actually. That is the starting point. And the interesting thing about the product is that it has a rather neutral flavor. I like to compare it often to like mineral water. Like you can taste some of the minerals inside, but it's not a particularly strong flavor. At the moment you mix it into something, you probably won't notice the flavor. What you will notice, however, is the texture. It has a very rich and creamy texture. If you eat it by itself, like literally just a spoonful, people often compare it to raw egg yolk that kind of like coats the inside of your mouth because it's so rich and creamy. If you blend it into things, so if you add it to things, it acts as an emulsifier. It gives some extra creaminess to products. In smoothies, kind of like a frozen banana or some yogurt, for example. And all of that, though, without any fat. Like in our product, there's absolutely no fat in the product. So it's all just the protein water, protein and water that creates this kind of mouthfeel. And in terms of what you can do with it, well, that's pretty much up to the individual. Like the interesting thing is that it's very, very versatile. Our customers often start with the same use cases that you have for the dried powder. So the juices, the smoothies, you can make spirulina bowls or yogurt bowls with it. But that's when it already starts to become more creative and people actually start using it in more ways than just the powder, because it tastes better and has a better texture and it's much more interesting. So people use it as a spread. I can recommend it on some toast, just a little bit of salt or lemon on it. You can make all kinds of beverages with it. Like we had people creating a spirulina mocha or a latte, a matcha latte with spirulina. You can incorporate it in salad dressings and pestos and dips of all sorts. You can even bake with it if you want to. Some people would say you lose some of the nutritional value, like with all vegetables. You know, it's really up to you, and the flexibility is really high when it comes to the use case.
Yeah, I think I had spirulina once when I was traveling in Puerto Rico, and I was in like a kind of like a health conscious hotel or something, and we had spirulina in our pancakes, so we had green pancakes. It was great.
Well, we actually had a cocktail bar working with our spirulina as well, but that's a different story. But like the pancakes is a good example of how a lot of parents use our spirulina as well to, you know, smuggle some healthy stuff into the kids' food. And like, okay, now it's suddenly green and this is so cool. And the kids eat it and they don't even taste it and are happy. And the parents are happy because it gives an extra nutrients to your kids.
And I don't want to be too jokey, but I was just thinking the next St. Paddy's Day parade could be way more healthier.
Or like going back to white beer, we should figure out how we can tint the beer with some spirulina.
Yes.
And some green beer going, right?
There's great microbreweries in the city, so you should definitely partner with someone who wants to do a Paddy's Day healthy whatever. I think that'd be fun. So,
this is an open request for proposal to all the microbreweries out there.
Exactly. Well, so back to that question, because I love that you said you got into this because of climate and carbon issues, you know, and you found a crop. So it wasn't like you had spirulina on the mind. It was about some other aspect that wasn't even really culinary, and it led you to grow a specific crop. And now you have essentially a packaged goods company, like you're selling a perishable good, but it's neatly packaged. It's very beautiful little jars of this very pleasant foam, this very, very deep blue-green foam. What is some of the science that's been compelling you? What are just, I don't know if you have any quick stats, anything you want to highlight that's like kind of blown your mind or things that really compelled you to get involved? Was there like a moment of discovery when you were like, spirulina, I'm going to get a tattoo, you know, like, I don't know. Was there that kind of story behind it or?
I think it was just a multitude of different things. Like the first thing that I think completely blew my mind is when I realized that the organism itself has about twice as much protein as a chicken breast. It's extremely protein dense. I think that combined with the additional minerals that are present from iron, the potassium, the copper, and so on, it made it just like this super intriguing organism. Then you can dive deeper into the history and like realize that this organism is like 3.6 billion years old, like billion, not million. That is like primordial kind of old, primordial soup. And it's one of the first photosynthetic active organisms. Like we found filaments of cyanobacteria, which is the scientific term for the type of algae that we grow. And they date back all the way until that time. And what we know today is that they played a very important role in an event during which another organism basically ate up this type of spirulina organism, which used photosynthesis for the first time, and the other organism was a predator. It was just like eating other types of things, and the predator was like, hey, that's actually a really useful skill. You can turn sunlight into energy, soup, and hunt for other things. I just incorporate you. And that is the beginning of all plant life, this merger between an outer cell and this first initial cyanobacteria led to the development of all kinds of plants, of all kinds of algae later on. And you can still see under the microscope the very same form of the very, very same structure that leads back to what we see today under the microscope in microalgae. And that long history is just super cool to me. And then I could go on forever, but like there's so many little things that sparked my interest. And I think a lot of folks that are into the world of fungi kind of have the same fascination, and they start get interested in one thing, and then they learn about the incredible bandwidth that exists within fungi and get totally absorbed in it. And that's the same for me for microalgae. There are thousands, if not millions, of strains of microalgae out there, freshwater, saltwater, and we've barely discovered a fraction of them all. And not even talking about which ones we think about eating, which is just a very, very limited number. And the enormous potential that lies within these types of microorganisms that we haven't even explored just, you know, speaks to my curiosity. And I'm like, wow, I can't wait to see what we are going to discover in the next couple of decades when it comes to microalgae.
That sounds amazing. And that's great, the kind of birth of plants in general, like the whole history of that. I have a two-part question. Sorry, we're so excited, asking so many questions. one is there a culture that you know that uses spirulina? Like spirulina is used within that culture's food ways and that type of thing. And then also, this is kind of a different question, but how do you actually farm spirulina?
Yeah, so there are many cultures, several cultures around the world that use spirulina. It's typically associated with cultures that are close to places where spirulina naturally occurs. The two that are the most prominent ones are in Africa. The Kanembo people cultivate spirulina in one of the volcanic basins around Lake Chad in Africa. It's a very historically or traditionally important crop for these people. It's a very interesting story, actually, that this type of algae grows in this volcanic lake, and only women are allowed to get in touch with this type of algae. So when it's time to harvest, the young women go into the lake and take baskets to siphon off the spirulina from the surface of the lake. And the older women are there to protect the lake from the men, which are not supposed to enter the lake because otherwise it will turn barren. And so it has become this very traditional food for them that has helped them during many times of famine, and is part of one of the core sauces, or rather, I don't know if sauce or spice mix is the right word. It's considered dihe. It's a mix with other ingredients that's used with vegetables and meats. And that's actually also where the Western world discovered spirulina, really, or rediscovered rather, when a French mycologist for the first time saw that in markets and was curious about it. And then the other part of the world is Mexico. In modern day Mexico City, we know today that the Aztecs used to cultivate spirulina as well. So around Lake Texcoco, which is right where modern day Mexico City is located, when the Spanish arrived, they actually put down an entire report on how the locals were using spirulina. They were comparing it to degree to their local cheese or to their own cheese, but couldn't really get warm with the flavor. So it wasn't really something that was translated back to Spain. However, what we know is that the Aztecs used to use it for long periods of time, and that their couriers that would travel between their capital, Tenochtitlan, and I'm sorry if I'm completely butchering this pronunciation here, and the other cities in the empire, and they would give this to the couriers as some form of ancient energy drink, energy food that they would take along. So there's been a long, long history in that, and even today, spirulina is considered one of the historical foods of Mexico. So cultivation of spirulina works in two different ways. The more traditional way, and by that I mean the more traditional commercial way, is done in raceway ponds. So they are large oval ponds that are open to the surface. They have a central divider where water is circulated in around, and the algae grows inside the water. The algae needs the exact same things that the plant needs: the NPK fertilizers, bunch of minerals, then sunlight. It needs carbon, typically in the form of CO2 or sodium bicarbonate, and then it does the photosynthesis and grows and multiplies over time. It's very similar to what most people know, either from their pool or from their little pond that they have in their backyard. So imagine that kind of algae bloom. It starts with a light green color, and then over time, the organism doubles and gets denser and denser. Now, today, there's been a lot of research into what is referred to as photobioreactors, which is just a fancy word for a closed cultivation device for algae. Like, they can come in all forms and shapes, but the hallmark here is that that everything happens in a much more controlled environment. You provide the lights, you provide measure the water quality and the sensors inside, because the fascinating thing about this type of algae is they can grow really, really fast, explosively fast. So as long as you provide the right growing conditions, you can really harness a lot of efficiency out of this. And that's essentially what we do too. We're cultivating indoors. So we have small tanks that are filled with the nutrient solution and the initial inoculum of spirulina. They grow lights that provide the light that the algae needs to grow. And then we provide enough carbon in the water for it to grow, and over the course of the next couple of days you end up with a denser and denser culture, and all you need to do at that point is harvest it, and you do that by running it through a multitude of filters that catch the algae. Remember, it's a very, very tiny organism, so we're talking about 25 micron or even smaller types of filters, but they catch the algae, and then you end up with, for the lack of a more culinary appealing term, a sludge of algae, which is still relatively high in water. And then you have multiple ways of processing it downstream. If you want to have a powder, you use a spray drying process to remove the water and dehydrate the product. In our case, we just gently remove the excess water and then process it into a fresh product or into a frozen product, which we also have.
Oh, that's great.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
So it sounds a little industrial, which is kind of where I want to go with like how you see yourself in terms of launching an urban agriculture business and participating in urban agriculture. And I guess, you know, a follow-up would be like, can you grow this at home? But I'm curious, there's sort of two pathways, like recommendations if someone wanted to get involved, but also, you know, really, how did you start a business? How did you get this kind of competency? Because it sounds like engineering is involved. It's maybe a little bit different than going out in a garden and planting a seed in the same way, you know, hydroponics is different, right? So these are like different techniques that are all happening in the city. So maybe I'm curious how you got that knowledge and you know, how it's going, really.
Well, mostly through reading a lot of stuff online and relying on some of the existing spirulina farmers that exist around the world. Some of the leading spirulina farmers are like small scale farmers are in France. There are a lot of manuals on how to grow spirulina out there. And, you know, in the end, it's not so different to anyone who's growing something in their garden for the first time. You just try on a very small scale and you fail often until you understand and understand how it works. So I remember in my early days having tiny little bottles with culture on my windowsill and like trying to get it going, and some of them worked and some didn't. And when we moved out of our lab at NYU and moved into our first commercial space, there were so many failed cultures and so many things that didn't work out. And eventually we got it going to a system that is extremely reliant and works really well. It's a big challenge in the industry. Like, it's not like you can go and study hydroponics, rather you can go and study hydroponics and then become a farmer. There are academic trainings in terms of algae out there. There's obviously a lot of science behind that, but not necessarily a lot of applied science. Like, how do you actually get going with the spirulina farm? Because I don't even know why. It's just not been an industry that's been in the focus for the last couple of decades.
I have a quick question. Is there any spirulina varieties that could actually be cultivated in salt water, or it has to be fresh water?
So spirulina is pretty much entirely, or the types of spirulina that we cultivate is cultivated in fresh water in a very alkaline solution. So there are lots of salts in the water. It's just not considered salt water. The sodium content is particularly high. But that's just one particular strain. I should probably clarify that a little bit more just to give people understanding. When we talk about microalgae is just a very generic term that is as broad as saying plants. Like, I should say algae equals plants. Like, plants, there are trees, there are vegetables, there are fruits. Like, there are so many different other terms underneath. And so that's also true for algae. There are red algae, there are green algae, there are brown algae, there are blue-green algae, and that's not even speaking to the size of the organism. So the specific strain that we grow, compare that maybe to romaine lettuce as like one specific thing, that's spirulina that we grow. The two different species within that, or at least the ones that are commercially sold. But there are hundreds of other strains that we know of, and some of them can grow in salt water and grow in different kinds of conditions, much like plants. Depending on what kind of algae you grow, they all grow in other types or in different types of conditions.
So What has surprised you as you've undertaken this? You've got all this knowledge together. What's it been like on the business side? So obviously you're very interested in the science and the technique, and you said you kind of learned looking at manuals and a lot of trial and error, do it yourself. Are there things you've learned in trying to, because that would all make sense for like a hobbyist. But you know, you've taken this to the scale of a business and you have other people involved and like employees, right? Like that's a little different. So how has that process gone? And I don't know, does that take away from the fun of growing? I mean, what is it like running an urban ag business?
Well, it certainly changes things, right? Like when I got started, and when many people get started because they're passionate about food and they're passionate about all the cool things about it, like growing all these cool varieties, like having fun in the garden and thinking about the great impact that they're going to have. And the reality is, though, when you decide to start a business, very quickly, you need to start talking in business terms as well, and you need to consider all the business terms as well. One of the things that I often tell people, like I'm mentoring students at NYU when they get started, and you know, they're very idealistic and they have great ideas and how their business can improve the world. But the first thing that you need to make sure is that you are financially sustainable. Like if you're not financially sustainable, then all your other impact forms don't matter. So that's your starting point. And that what that means in terms of our business is the first thing that you need to ensure is that whatever you grow, you actually have someone on the other side who wants to buy it. Not only consume it, but wants to actually pay for it to purchase it from you. This is a very sobering approach and a very probably not as fun as thinking about all the cool things that you grow, but in the end, it's at least as important as everything else if you want to operate a business. So all the cool things that we're talking about here right now, the fascination around algae and the possibility and the potential systemic impact, they're worth nothing in the end if we don't figure out how we sell this to our customers and what is the value that we provide them with our products. And that was something that we needed to learn in the beginning, and that is sometimes hard to balance, like your idealistic approach and what are the things that people are willing to pay for.
For some reason, I keep on thinking of like spirulina would be really great. For some reason in growing food, like let's say, has NASA kind of experimented with that? Because it's such high protein and it sounds like you don't need a lot of space for it. And that you could dry it as well. So I don't know, for some reason, I just think about like NASA using it and like, or folks using it when they're up in space, or I think about, what is that? The biodome. If only they had spirulina, yes. They could have taken out their CO2 and could have eaten things more. I don't know. Just thoughts. Weird thoughts.
Well, it's definitely, it makes a good space food. NASA has definitely done some research on spirulina. Like we often talk about the potential for like long distance space travel, like if you want to go to Mars and so on. Like in that kind of scenario, we're talking about like multi-year transit. You cannot just like put everything in storage. You probably need to find a way to cultivate at least some food on the journey. Like even if it's like not possible to put all the nutrients into your storage, people still want to have like fresh things, and like it's good for your mental health. It's good for like, I think we don't even understand all the benefits that come from that yet. And I think what I'm trying to say is spirulina is a very interesting crop for that then, because it can be cultivated with almost no like need of space or like land in more terrestrial terms. And it provides such a bandwidth of nutrients and vitamins in doing so. Yeah, NASA has done multiple papers on it and is always considering it. So yeah, NASA, if you're looking for someone to go to Mars, here I am. I can help you.
Yeah, this was actually a really big deal at NASA. I believe it was the 60s and 70s. They hired the great systems ecologists, the Odum brothers, to work on microalgae cultivation in space with the idea of completely recirculating waste and creating oxygen and creating food and just being able to maintain. Like, basically, the experimental question was, if you sent one dude up in a tin can, it was dudes at the time, how much algae would you need and how could you have redundancy built in to not screw it up, to keep that person alive indefinitely for just in the ways you cite. So like, you wouldn't need to send up a bunch of candy bars, which eventually run out because you have an infinite supply of food because it grows and it also filters air. The problem was they could never get it to work experimentally. They tried with mice a bunch and different, they eventually tried something very different where it's like, let's just bring a whole lake, like a lot of organisms together. But that whole line of research was eventually defunded. And basically NASA figured, you know, long story short, it was cheaper to send people up with candy bars and they were only ever going for shorter stints. Even ISS now, you go up for a few weeks, a few months, is quite long, and there's lots of problems with being in space. But absolutely, I think that whole era is ending as people put their eyes on Mars. Like, sci-fi TV will tell you everyone's obsessed with going to Mars. There's like multiple shows about the first trip to Mars. And I mean, if you're gonna go 2 years out at best, if everything goes right, yeah, you're definitely gonna need to grow some food. So I think, you know, they're looking at aeroponics, I should say, and definitely algae. So it'd be really interesting if your company, just by dint of like, there are billionaires who want to go to Mars now, just, you know, got a big boost from like these experiments.
Well, I mean, the other thing is, if you go to Mars, you can never come back. Do they ever tell people that? Because of gravity, you can't come back. The gravity, especially if you spend any amount of time on Mars, the gravity is so different that if you came back to Earth, you would probably be crushed by our gravity. So it's like, if you become a spirulina farmer, that's it. You're going to be a spirulina farmer. You will be the new farmers on Mars, farming spirulina. So just putting that out there, Jonas.
Damn. Well, maybe I need to focus more on terrestrial problems then again.
Yeah, there might be enough to do here on Earth. Well, this is great. So what is next for We Are the New Farmers? So maybe if you could tell us, I think, just so it's clear, you currently sell basically jars of fresh algae and also sort of pre-frozen cubes, right? Is that correct? Those are sort of the two different sizes of those.
That is right. Yeah.
Okay. And so what's next? Is there something else in the horizon? Is the goal basically get more people to try this stuff and see the nutritional benefit? Any cool partnerships, anything you want to announce? I mean,
God, there's so much that's going on right now. I think the two most important things, I think, is that we are expanding. We're still operating out of our very first tiny farm, and we're building a new facility right now to really expand our production footprint and to really, you know, bring down pricing as well. That's just the nature of these things. And that's very exciting for us. So I'll be on the lookout when we soon be able to announce a little bit more formally our new facilities. And then secondly, you know us as, a D2C brand. Like, you can go to a website, place an order, ship it straight to your doors. But we are increasingly also working with businesses all across the United States, actually. We've been signing on to shops and smoothie shops that offer our products. We're working with food manufacturers across the country. So that is an increasingly important channel for us. I think it just speaks to an overall observation that I'm having at the moment. And that is, a couple of years ago when we started, no one really knew what we were doing. And now we've reached a point where more and more people are really, really interested in microalgae. It almost is like a first wave of a little boom that we're seeing here right now. And people are getting it and like, oh my God, this is such a cool organism, and they find ways to use it in like such cool ways in all kinds of beverages and food. And that's what makes me super exciting. And that's what, you know, I'm very excited to see what's going to come for us in the next couple of months as we now find new partners and continue to develop our business.
Great. Well, that all sounds very exciting, and congrats on the announcements. You can't quite announce about, you know, new, whatever it is, new expansions and whatnot. And we'll have to have you back on. You know, I think maybe Melissa, you can have the last word as a sort of penultimate question. You know, I always tend to ask, and I know you're very smart and read lots of things, so I'm just very curious whether it has to do with spirulina or not. I'm sure it will, but you know, what is your vision for like urban agriculture in New York City and cities in general? Like what's a good outcome? What should happen in the next few years? Maybe not, you know, all the level of space travel, but you know, down here on Earth, we have a lot of issues. What are some positive news you want to highlight, things you wish to support? You know, what should we focus on?
Yeah, I think we're in a very, very exciting time here in New York City when it comes to urban agriculture right now. Like as we're recording this just a few weeks ago, the Office of Urban Agriculture has been finally put into life. And I think that it's going to give a lot of business and a lot of new developments and just some extra momentum. I don't know. Like, I think there's so much that is already happening, and I think it's just not necessarily on the public radar of all the cool work that community gardens are doing, the community organizations that do amazing work to combat food deserts. So I'm more on the visionary side, and I think like what could be, like what could change to make this this place even more amazing. And I think I had this thought the other day. I had a conversation with someone around kelp and about the experiments that people are doing around growing kelp in New York State. And I was wondering, we have like such an amazing restaurant scene here in New York City. So how can we integrate our urban farming community and our local crops, and not necessarily just saying things that are grown right here in the city, but really in the whole ecosystem that exists more into the amazing restaurant world that we have. We have some of the most creative chefs in the entire country, probably in the entire world. We have an extremely, extremely curious audience here in New York, where people are not shy to try out new things that might be considered a little weird or a little out there. So I wish it would be better or easier to integrate those two, that, you know, the urban farmer that in Sunset Park grows a heritage Mexican herb, finds their Mexican chef somewhere in Manhattan that comes up with the most amazing application. The seafood restaurants in the city not being shy to try out New York grown sugar kelp and find the best new applications for kelp. And I think that is something. This integration between these two industries, I'd love to see that a little more and be more adventurous around the things that we see on our plates.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. And just being the background that I used to be a gardener for a restaurant in Bushwick at Roberta's. And it's funny because I could see, I worked with chefs and they were definitely very interested in all the strange, you know, things that I could grow, and also just a small amount of things that I could grow. They'd be like, "Oh, we could just use that for a tasting, you know, menu or something like that." I guess one of the things that I see that can happen is just the price point of, like, if you're growing food in an urban area, a lot of times the price point might be a little bit more, just because the economics of growing food in an urban area. And, but it depends on what restaurant you're selling to, right? Like, some restaurants would be okay with that price point, where others may not be able to be okay with that price point. So I think that's one issue that I just saw. But I think some of the chefs that I still worked with, depending on how accessible that ingredient is, they would be willing to pay a little bit more for it if it wasn't as accessible and if it was fresh. So yeah, going back to this idea of fresh spirulina, how, you know, that's an item that they can't get everywhere, you know? So
exactly. I think it has two components, right? Of course, the New York restaurant scene is also extremely competitive. I know that margins are very, very low, and everyone just needs to have on the menu what sells. And so there's a lot of pressure on that. So I think what I'm hoping for is to find a way to alleviate some of that pressure, like, to, you know, stay in the visionary world here, where like there's a program where restaurants get a small grant to like find a new crop that is better for the environment and grown locally, like, and they find a way to put it on the menu for a short period of time and find a new use case. And if it works, then it can keep going. And if it doesn't, then they haven't lost anything. I think finding these kind of mechanisms to, you know, integrate more sustainably grown produce into menus and open up kind of the palette of things that we use. If not in New York City, then where else would that happen?
Yeah. And I also love the movement of like eating invasive species.
Oh yeah.
You know, just putting out, and I know I'm joking a lot, but I do love what you're doing, Yaris. But I'm like, you know, chefs, if you're listening, lantern flies, I don't know, heard they're bitter. Maybe let me do some. Just, I don't know why I'm joking so much.
No, that's great. Lantern flies and children, right? That's what Jonathan Swift said.
What?
Modest Proposal. So yeah, this is all great. And I think one of the I guess really, you know, final questions, unless Melissa, you have more, is we should let you kind of shout out, where can people find you? What do you want people to do? Do you want them to go to your website? Do you interact a lot on social media? Are you around, Jonas?
Yeah, if you personally want to connect, best way is probably to find me on LinkedIn. I'm sure in the show notes you can share my name that people can actually understand how it's spelled. You can find me there. If you want to find more or learn more about Weirdo New Farmers, you can visit our website. That's new-farmers.com. Or you can find us on TikTok as well as on Instagram. The handle, We Are the New Farmers.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's always really great to check in. And I feel like we could talk about, you know, micronutrients and carbon sequestration and kelp and space travel all day. So we may have to have you back on. If you're doing anything fun, let us know. If fields can come out. And yeah, until then, we'll have to get together and cook or not cook with composite foods using some algae.
Yeah. And also, Jonas, it's just been such a pleasure to see that, you know, starting as a student and kind of experimenting into making this a whole company, which has been actually really amazing to see. So congratulations on that.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for inviting me here on this podcast. This is a lot of fun. I know we could talk probably for another hour and I can like geek out on all the little things about algae. Always happy to chat.
Great. Well, thanks a lot. And thanks to everyone who listens to Fields, and thanks to Heritage Radio Network for making the best food podcasts and radio in the world, or at least in New York. Thanks a lot. We'll catch you next time. This is Fields. Happy growing, happy harvesting.
Fields is powered by Riverside. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradio.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage, and thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.